We are seeing a lot of the symptoms. How do you get to the root of the problem?
I think you listen. You listen to women and you hear what they're telling you and you hear the cacophony of voices when they say to you, this isn't working. You collect the data and you decide to create change. Set goals and make things happen.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to GeekWire. It's Todd Bishop.
And Monica Nicholsberg.
Our guest on today's show is Melinda Gates.
That's right. We had the opportunity to sit down with Melinda last week for a really interesting discussion about her new book, The Moment of Lift.
The book is about empowering women and changing the world. And it was a fascinating conversation that not only touched on Melinda Gates's work in global health, but also had a lot of relevant insights and guidance for people in business and technology here in the United States.
Yeah, she talks about some really important themes, but she does it in a really accessible way where it's told through the stories of these women she's met all over the world through her work with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and her own personal story. So you get some really revealing insights into what her life has been like as this powerhouse and married to Bill Gates.
She is a force in her own right. She went to Duke University, earned bachelor's degrees in computer science and economics and a master's degree in business, and then worked at Microsoft for nearly a decade. It's a fascinating book. We hope you enjoy the conversation, and we'll be back at the end to share some of our own thoughts on the book and share a fun highlight from the final stop on Melinda Gates' book tour in Seattle.
So with that, let's jump into our conversation with Melinda Gates. Welcome to GeekWire, Melinda Gates. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So we are here to talk about your new book, The Moment of Lift. And this book is really about how if you empower women throughout the world, then you lift up everyone. You tell that story through all of these incredible women and their experiences, including your own. So if you could draw a line connecting each of them, what would it be?
It would be that we so often don't look at the issues that women face in societies all over the world, these barriers. And if we would recognize the barriers, which I write chapter after chapter in the book, if we'd recognize the barriers and lift them, lift those barriers, and then we invest in women, then women invest in everybody else, and it changes our societies all over the world.
And some of those barriers happen in the workplace, particularly in tech, where you got your start. I really identified with the portion of the book when you talked about the early culture at Microsoft and how you struggled with the brashness and how aggressive and competitive it was. And this is still a persistent problem in tech. So I'm curious what advice you would give to other women on how they can be courageous enough to be themselves and be vulnerable when oftentimes they're the only woman in the room.
Yeah, I think we have to start a little bit with how did tech get the way it is? Because when in the late 1980s, when I was in computer science, we were on our way up. Computer science degrees held by women, we were graduating at a rate of about 37%. And we were on our way up, like law and like medicine, which have reached now essentially parity for men and women in terms of degrees. Then in the computer industry, we dropped down all the way to 18%. We're on a slight uptick now. We don't know exactly why that is, but we believe it's because the personal computer began to be marketed towards boys in the home. Then there were more computer games, and so boys played those. And then by the time women went into the tech industry, they felt inexperienced because boys had so much more experience. So I think we have a persistent problem in the tech industry, but I'm also optimistic we can change it. And when I think about the industry today, I think about not a leaky pipeline, which so many people talk about, but how for women, but how do we create pathways in for women to help them understand what creative jobs these are, that you actually code in teams, that you don't have to be a white guy in his hoodie. And I think when we start to create more pathways in, for instance, that first class freshman year of computer science, when you make that welcoming in real world problems, it begins to change things for women.
One of the things that struck me was that you were writing about your early experiences at Microsoft, and that was in large part, a culture that Bill created. Did you have any moments in the process of writing this book where the two of you talked about that and discussed what that meant for you in your life? Because it was a dramatic impact. You talked about leaving at one point, thought about leaving.
Yeah. So Bill and I have talked about this over the years, not during the time I was at Microsoft, because it would be inappropriate when I was there for me to discuss work with him, I felt, if I was still managing teams, which I was. I was there for 9 years. I had a fabulous career. But yes, Microsoft was started by a group of very young guys. And I would say that you're not at your most mature when you are, you know, around age 21 and starting a company. And so some things got set in motion there and patterns that now I think Satya is working very consistently to break down. And he's very clear about that. And what I will say about Bill is that he has become a much more mature leader over time. And the way we run the foundation, both as true equal partners and what we expect of ourselves as leaders and what we expect of others, is the culture that I think more people would like to work in. So it's been an interesting journey for us as a couple to name what we want and need in culture. And it's been a maturation process for both of us.
In some ways, things haven't changed that much since when you were there, though. I mean, I know there was that email chain that went around where a lot of women were describing experiences where they didn't really feel supported at Microsoft. Is that discouraging to you?
I am optimistic. And the reason I am is it takes transparency to create change. And so Satya and Kathleen, who's the head of HR, have been very outspoken about what they expect in their company culture. I think they've been creating change. And I think this latest wave where you saw so many women come forward with their stories meant that they felt safe bringing their stories forward. And you see Microsoft's response in the last few weeks. And what I know is that a consistent transparency followed by a consistent response is what will create change. So I'm quite optimistic.
What would be your message for the tech industry, big picture, on these issues? If there was one thing you could change, if there was one action item, you know, everybody walks out of meetings with their action items, what would they be for the tech industry?
For the tech industry, there is no silver bullet. But what I would say is absolutely make sure that in every single meeting you're in, women have a seat at the table. Not one woman, many women. Women cannot act alone on behalf of other women. You want to have the most creative products. You want to sell to the biggest market, which is actually women who make purchasing decisions on behalf of the family. You should have women at the table. And if you don't, then it's time you do. And have transparency. Make sure that you are promoting women equally to men, you're paying women equally to men, and you're walking the talk. And what I'm starting to see because of the labor force shortage, the supply of women coming out with computer science degrees, they're voting with their feet. And so they're choosing now companies that have the culture they want. So if you don't get with the times are going to leave you behind.
One really striking part of the book is the health worker in India who asked you if you would do anything to feed your children. And she was referring to a group of sex workers who you were attempting to help prevent the spread of HIV through. And it was kind of a challenge. She wanted you to be able to empathize with these women and see that under their circumstances, anyone would do the same thing. I'm wondering what kind of lessons you can learn from that sort of radical empathy and apply to the business community for men or anyone who's in a position of power to empathize with an underrepresented group.
I think we've had a certain work culture for a long time in the United States that really goes back to the 1950s and 1960s. And we still have that sometimes embedded in our brains where we think it's a culture where men work and women sort of stay home and are taking care of everything at home. And that is not the truth anymore. 47% of the U.S. workforce are women. And so what I know is that when men and women can talk about what they fully care about in the workplace, which many of them care about their families and their loved ones and their friends, when they can bring their whole selves to work, whether they're a man or a woman, including empathy, then I think you start to change the workforce. And I'm starting to see that in places. I see it in a lot of young startups. I see it in the healthcare industry quite often because there's more women working in that field. So again, I'm impatient for things to get better quickly, but I do think they are getting better for women. I think this is the best time to be a woman in the United States that we've ever seen before.
Yeah. I want to talk about unpaid work.
Sure, me too.
And I was telling Todd on the drive over that since reading your book, I've been asking for a lot more unpaid work to be done, to be shared around my house, and it's been great. It's been great for everybody. But I think we have to back up before we jump into it, because there are a lot of people who this still doesn't really register to them, this concept of unpaid work. I mean, how would you frame it in a nutshell?
This is one of the barriers I want to bring up, or I do bring up in my book. So first of all, unpaid labor or work are the things that we do in our homes. Some of them are things we want to do, caring for our loved ones, for the elderly or young children. But many of the things we do in our home are things that simply need to get done. Chores, lunch boxes, doing the dishes, doing the laundry, shopping. And there is no place in the world where women and men do the same amount of unpaid labor. And in the United States, women do 90 minutes more per day than their husband. 90 minutes more. So that's time that she could be in the gym, investing in her health, maybe getting another degree, maybe doing something else she wants to do after work. So we need to look at that unpaid labor, and we need to figure out, are there, you know, there are certain things that help us reduce that labor over time. But it's really, at this point, it's about redistributing in our households and naming what we need. And our spouses stepping up and say, hey, you know what? Just because I came into the marriage assuming you would do that or assuming I wouldn't do that, I need to step up and take more responsibility in the home.
Is there anything that employers can do to balance the scales of unpaid work?
Well, I am big on talking about paid family medical leave in the United States. We are the only industrialized nation, the only one that does not have paid family medical leave. And so 17% of the U.S. workforce is all that has access to paid family medical leave. And I believe that if we pass a robust, a good policy for this, people will start to rebalance and think about men's and women's roles, both in work and at the birth of a child, or when there's an aging parent. Because quite often a man and a woman has aging parents, and who takes care of them? I think if you had paid family medical leave and both men and women actually take it, like countries like Sweden who've had it for a long time do, it starts to change the balance of how we think about work and family life.
I just spent quite a bit of time researching paid leave for a story, and the Gates Foundation came up because you really pushed the limits of how comprehensive a paid leave policy you can offer as an employer. It was a year, but you found that that was not really practical and recently reduced it to 6 months plus a $20,000 stipend. What were some of the lessons you learned from that?
Yes. So when we rolled out our paid family medical leave policy 3 years ago, we were one of only two companies in the United States that had that robust of a paid family medical leave policy. As we worked with it and with the organization over 3 years, what we found was that it was putting more burden on the work that we want to get done in the world than we wanted it to. And so we believe in balancing family and work life, but we felt we had tipped a bit too far in terms of the family piece of it. So what we decided to do that we also have some experience with from my own office, Pivotal Ventures, and also from Bill's office, Gates Ventures, was that 6 months seems to be the right amount for now of paid family medical leave, where a family can absolutely have time to care for their elderly, their loved one, care for the birth of the new child, but then $20,000 to support childcare as they come back into the workplace. But that seems to be about right in terms of men and women then coming back to work. And I think that'll help us be the most efficient as a organization with the resources that we have and support families.
What if it's a startup that doesn't have the kind of endowment that the Gates Foundation does, but it's bringing up the same kind of challenges that you raised, that, you know, it's too challenging to get anything done. We're in growth mode. We're small. We're scrappy. How can a smaller company like that still support women?
I'm watching some of these small companies do very interesting things. So I've seen a few startups, actually a couple here in Seattle, decide that they're going to allow the mom, while she's still nursing, to bring her baby to work at times. And so they create a space for that, a space for a caregiver for the child and for the mom to go not just to nurse the child, but for the child to be there either part or all of the day. So there are creative ways you can do it. I'm not saying it's easy to do, but I think the message you send to employees about how we care about family and work changes, and what we find is that employees who feel their employer understands their overall life is likely to stay longer at a company.
When we come back, Melinda Gates tells us about some of the women who have influenced her own life, including the IBM hiring manager who sent her career and her life in a new direction by suggesting she not work for IBM.
I wanted a career in IT, but I didn't know where to start. WGU makes it simple. Their accredited online degree programs cover all kinds of IT specialties, and they have valuable industry certifications built in at no extra cost. The payoff? Having those certs back up my degree makes me look even better to future employers. A nonprofit university that includes top industry certs in their programs? I choose WGU. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT certs included.
One of the remarkable things about the book is that you're telling the stories of women that you've met along the way, but there's also women who've influenced your life. And I wondered if you might, in succession, tell us about these three women from the book.
Okay.
Mrs. Bauer, your computer science teacher, the unnamed IBM manager who told you to go work for Microsoft, and Anna.
Okay, sure. So Mrs. Susan Bauer was my math teacher in high school. I went to an all-girls Catholic high school, and she went to a conference one weekend, and she saw computers. They were actually Apple II computers. And she came back from the conference and went to the head nun of the school and said, "We have to get these for the girls." And she convinced the head nun to put up the budget, and they bought 5 Apple II computers for us 600 girls. And I was part of the very first small coding class. And what I learned in that class was how much I loved coding. And I learned from a teacher who let us get out in front of her. And she taught me that to be a leader, you don't have to actually know everything. And her getting those computers influenced my path. So by the time I went to college, I knew I wanted to study computer science. I went to Duke University for undergraduate to study computer science and graduate in that, got my MBA. As I was coming out of business school at Duke's Fuqua School of Business, I had a longstanding job offer from IBM. I'd worked for them in Dallas for several summers. And so over my spring break, I went back to IBM in Dallas. The hiring manager that I met with, a woman, said, "Are you ready to accept our offer?" And I said, "Well, you know, I interviewed a lot of other places, turned them all down. I have this one more small company I'm going to go interview with, and then I'll probably come back and take this job." And she said, "Would you mind me asking who that is?" And I said, "Well, it's this little company called Microsoft in Seattle." And this was 1987. Microsoft was still less than 1,700 employees. And she said, "Oh, I know that company." She said, "Do you want a piece of advice?" And I said, "Sure." And she said, "If you get an offer from Microsoft, you should accept it." And she just floored me. This was my hiring manager. And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Because as a woman," she said, "I think you would do quite well at IBM, have a successful career. But, you know, there are levels here that you'll have to move up through systematically." And she said, "At a young startup like that, if you're as good as it seems like you are," she said, "I think your rise would be meteoric." And I thought, wow, what an amazing piece of advice. And sure enough, I interviewed and got a job offer, and I knew I should take it.
And it turned out to be very good advice.
It did. It changed my life in many ways. But what I liked about Microsoft was they were creating the future. And that's what I love about tech for women and for men, too. But it is our future. We are creating our future through technology. They're some of the best jobs or the best paying jobs, many of them in the United States. But they're also creating the future that we want. And that's why I'm so passionate about making sure that women and people of color have a seat at the table. So the other story is about Anna. When our oldest daughter was 15, Jen, she and I went to live for several days in Tanzania. A family said they would take us into their home. It was actually their goat hut that we stayed in. And they're a Maasai family. Anna is the mom of the family and Sonari is her husband. We stayed over several days and Jen and I followed Anna around her farm all day doing the tasks that Anna do. We also followed Sonari on one day and we chopped wood with Anna. We carried water with Anna, which is what women are expected to do in the developing world. They carry the water, not the men. And we cooked. I cooked in the cooking hut probably 6 hours that day, and we did the dishes, the women and her sister and her daughter at night in the dust at 10 at night under the stars. And what I learned from Anna was about unpaid work. And after I'd been cooking with her for quite a number of hours, I was interviewing her about her job, about her life, and she said she was clearly in a relationship she wanted to be in. It was a loving relationship. Sonari confirmed that later, her husband. But she said, you know, I almost left Sonari at one point. And I said, really? Why? And she said, well, the birth of our first son, Robert, she said, I just couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't carry water and nurse my baby. So Sonari confirmed that he came home one day and there was Anna sitting on the doorstep with her bag packed, baby in her arms. And she said, I'm leaving you. And he was stricken. He was heartbroken. He said, what do you mean you're leaving me? And she said, well, your land is very arid. I'm going to go back to the more lush homeland that I came from because I can't do this anymore. And so he asked that simple question, which is, what can I do? And she said, well, you could carry water. And Maasai men do not carry water. And Sonari said he would. And so he started walking to the well. The other Maasai men made fun of him. He was walking miles a day, and they said he was bewitched. But they started walking with him. And so inadvertently, they were walking in on his footsteps. And after a while, the men all started to bike to the well and get water, and they realized how exhausting it was. And finally, they came up with this idea, why don't we build water pans around our villages? And they did. And that story of, in a moment of Anna naming what she needed so she could nurse and care for her son, and her husband responding, that is unpaid work. And that is a real relationship where you work through issues of naming what you need and somebody responding.
And it's amazing because you had such a parallel experience, albeit not as extreme, but something very similar happened with you and with Bill, and the result of him taking over was also very similar. Do you mind telling that story?
Sure. So with our first daughter, Jen, it came time for her to go to kindergarten. We both agreed the school we wanted her in, but it was not near our home in Seattle. And I could see all these years ahead of driving on the freeway and in the traffic in Seattle. We had two children at this point. And so I had said to Bill, look, let's just wait till she's in third grade and we'll put her in that school. And he said, no, no. He felt strongly she go at kindergarten. And he was working full time as CEO of Microsoft. And I just said, I don't want to, you know, driving 5 days a week, twice a week in traffic. I could see, you know, it ahead. And he said, what can I do? And before I even was able to answer, he said, you know, I could drive two mornings a week. And I said, really? You would drive two mornings a week? Because it was almost an hour commute for him back to Microsoft, which was further away. And he said, yeah, I will. And he started doing it. And about 3 weeks into the school year, a mom sidled up to me and said, do you notice anything different going on in this classroom? And I said, yeah, so many dads are coming in and dropping off. And she said, yeah, we went home and said to our husbands, by gosh, if Bill Gates can do it, so can you. So inadvertently, we role modeled by asking what I needed and Bill offering, we role modeled something in the community. And that's what change looks like.
One common theme in your story is that you don't bow down to institutions just for the sake of doing so. And I'm thinking in particular the Catholic Church and contraception. What did you learn from that experience where you were on the front page of the Vatican newspaper about how to approach it in a way that creates change while still being able to exist within the institution?
What I have learned is to look for our common humanity and look at where we are the same and not different. And what I see in parents all over the world is that they love their children and they have the same hopes and dreams for their children that we have here in the United States. And yet women can't fulfill their hopes and dreams for their children because of lack of access to contraceptives, voluntary access. And so as I would be traveling and women kept bringing this up over and over and over to me, I honestly, because of my Catholic roots, kind of wanted to turn away from it and say, no, somebody else will do that. But the truth is, 220 million women were asking us for this tool. And so I finally realized I would overcome my own fears. So I learned how to be a more courageous leader, quite honestly, and how to say, what do I believe in? And as I started to realize, you know, I have met so many women who know somebody and men who have died in childbirth, men and women who say, my sister died in childbirth. My mom had struggled. We know babies who've died. I thought, it's a man-made rule to say women can't use contraceptives. And yet my religion also says, love thy neighbor. And if you love thy neighbor and you empathize with him, you deliver the tool that women at a more than 90% rate use in the United States. And so I learned that I needed to speak my truth, even if my church disagrees with me. And my truth is that I believe in saving other lives.
I think that story reflects a broader theme throughout the book, which is often in your work in the Gates Foundation, you go in seeking to address a problem like women's maternal health and realize that you have to get to the root of the problem, which is a lot more complicated. And so now I'm thinking of the sex workers in India whom you wanted to get to use condoms to stem the tide of HIV. And they told you, we need you to do something about violence. And it was a similar situation where it didn't seem like it was quite in the Gates Foundation's charter, but you ended up going there. So I wonder if there are lessons from that that can be translated to some of the inequity that women in the American workforce face. We are seeing a lot of the symptoms. How do you get to the root of the problem?
I think you listen. You listen to women and you hear what they're telling you and you hear the cacophony of voices when they say to you, this isn't working. Yes, you may want us to lead more, but we can't lead if we need time off for the care to care for our loved ones and we're in charge of taking the child to the doctor and being there for the homework and being there to comfort them when they have tears. You're putting us in an impossible situation. Then you listen to what women are telling you. You collect the data and you decide to create change. And all you got to do is set a goal and do it. So paid family medical leave, we just need a policy. We need to stop acting like it's possible to do what women are doing all over the United States, which is working and raising families. And we just have to listen to them and then we have to move forward, set goals and make things happen. And stop saying, hey, these issues are the fault of women. No, these are barriers that society's created that have held women back.
Melinda Gates, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Monica and Todd.
Melinda Gates' new book, The Moment of Lift, is available now. And we'll be back with some of our own thoughts on the book, plus a highlight from the final stop on her book tour. Welcome back to GeekWire. I'm Todd Bishop here with Monica Nicholsberg. And Monica, that was a real thrill to be able to sit down with Melinda Gates for me. And it was fun to hear your questions for her. What were your key takeaways from the conversation and from the book?
It was a really great experience. I mentioned earlier that the book is very accessible. It talks about these big concepts in a way that is easy for the reader to understand, even if they're not really primed with this material. And Melinda struck me as the same way. You know, she's very deeply immersed in these issues that affect women and communities all over the world. But she's able to talk about it in a way that you can understand, even if you've never thought of a concept like unpaid work, which is a huge theme of this book.
For me, the word that I would use to describe the book along those lines is authentic. I think Melinda Gates clearly has lived this life in a way that has informed her opinions with real world experiences. And that came through. I think in a lot of these books, my natural reaction is to be somewhat skeptical because it's very easy for authors to fall back on platitudes and things that don't actually give you new insight on problems that you might be aware of. I think for me, there was one page in the book that really just brought everything home. And that's because there were real world examples from Melinda's own life. One was the anecdote that she told about Bill dropping Jen, their daughter, off at school. And
all the other dads started coming. Because if Bill Gates can drive his daughter to school, then nobody else has a good excuse not to.
Exactly. And then the other was the story from the Gates house where whenever they have dinner, nobody leaves the kitchen until everything is done. The thing that struck me about that was not just the anecdote, but what she said about it afterward, because she acknowledged, hey, it's very easy to sit here and say this as a privileged woman that, you know, I've gotten my family to do the dishes with me. But she said, quote, I'm describing my own scene, not because it's a problem, but because it's my vantage point on the problem. That to me really drove this home. It's not individual problems that individual women are facing, that individual families and individual men are facing. It is a societal problem. This happens to be her view on it, and it happens to be extremely well informed by her experiences around the world.
And there's a really interesting spectrum that you get in this book, because it's hard to make a case that there's any more privileged woman in America than Melinda Gates. However, she still is dealing with some of the same problems of a higher expectation that women will do unpaid work around the house than men, and that causes friction in her marriage and in her life. And then through the stories of the women she meets through the foundation, you have the other side of the spectrum of privilege, where there are women, there's one woman she references who her child is malnourished and she needs to take her to a facility for 2 weeks if she's going to survive. And she can't because her husband and no other men in the family will step in to do the work that needs to be done from sunup to sundown around the house for their family to survive. And so fortunately, in this case, UN health workers stepped in, but they said this is not unusual, that there are women everywhere who are just watching their babies starve, essentially, because they cannot be unshackled from unpaid work. So having Melinda be the one to tell this story is really interesting, and you get a sense of some very complicated dynamics.
I thought that the moment where she talked about Microsoft changing over the years, and then you pointed out during the conversation, Monica, that, well, has it changed all that much? She said, well, the fact that these women are able to talk about these issues without fear of repercussion is at least a good first step. You could challenge that as well, but I think big picture, it's good to take in her insights on the tech industry as well, particularly given her experience at Microsoft. And it is kind of an interesting dynamic there where her husband effectively helped in his youth to create that culture.
There's no vantage point quite like Melinda Gates, and I think that's what makes this book really interesting. And hearing about issues that affect women and therefore humanity through her voice is really interesting.
After we got done with this interview, I got a chance to go down to McCaw Hall in Seattle. It was packed. This is a place that seats almost 3,000 people, and it was sold out for the final stop in Melinda Gates' book tour. They were there, clearly, to see Melinda, but then they got a bit of a surprise in the intro. Let's listen into what happened.
Good evening. I get to introduce Melinda for the last stop on her book tour. She's been all over the country the last 2.5 weeks, practicing up just for this appearance here in her home city. Melinda's obviously at the center of my life. She's a great wife, a great mother, an incredible partner in the foundation. And we always try and support each other and learn from each other. One story that she tells in the book is from quite a long time ago when we were both going to speak down at the Seattle Convention Center. And I was going first. She hadn't done a lot of public speaking, so she said, hey, I want you to leave. I don't want you in the audience because that'll make me nervous. I'll be thinking about what you would have said. So I got in the car and just drove around and waited until she was done and then drove her home. Now she's got a lot more experience. I think she's going to let me stay in the audience tonight. But now I'm the one who's a bit nervous because introducing your wife, you know, for a book tour, you know, what should you do that's special? And I was so unsure about this, I called up a friend and I said, hey, you've got experience. What is your advice to me?
Hello? Who? Oh, Bill. Right. Melinda's over.
In case you don't recognize that voice, that's former President Barack Obama. And he goes on in that pre-recorded video to give Bill Gates all sorts of advice for gifts that he could surprise Melinda Gates with, ranging from a mariachi band to an ice sculpture. And you can see the full video at Melinda Gates' Instagram account.
So that was very helpful advice. I decided I'd save the flowers for Mother's Day. It's pretty soon. So my gift to Melinda is simply to tell her the moment we met was my moment of lift.
All right, that was a really fun moment from the final stop in Melinda Gates' book tour. And in case you couldn't tell, Bill Gates was really choking up there. I've only seen that happen once before, which was at one of his last Microsoft shareholder meetings before he stepped down from day-to-day work at the company. So it was a really cool moment between the two of them and sort of a nice way to round out the trip and bring it on home.
Go to GeekWire.com for full coverage of our conversation with Melinda and related content.
And don't forget to subscribe to the GeekWire podcast in your favorite podcast app so you don't miss any interview or episode. We've got lots of great shows coming up, and we thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm Todd Bishop.
I'm Monica Nicholsberg.
We'll talk to you next time on GeekWire.